You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. We acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Wurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand. Respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past, present and emerging. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our broadcast reaches. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. My name is Shay and I'm your host for this week's episode. The topic that I've chosen for today is inspired by an interview I did with Jan White a few years ago. Jan White is an early childhood educator, and a lot of her work is centered around how to build an ecological identity in young children, which she describes as a deep identification with nature as part of the growing sense of self. I think this concept of ecological identity is really important to climate activism because so much of our white Western capitalist society works to pull children away from nature, away from the outdoors, so much so that the way kids are growing up and learning to inhabit the earth is to be separate from it, and to view it as a resource to use or something to control. And I think part of the task of being a climate activist is to lead and encourage a new generation of activists who will want to care for, love, and nurture their environment. We already see so many inspiring young people who are very active in climate change conversations and activist spaces, but I think there is more work to be done in nurturing young children to care for and feel a part of the world from a young age. The interview I did with Jan was published in Emesh magazine last year, and I'm going to read out some snippets from it. Then we will hear a conversation I had with Sue Wiedemann, who is also by chance my mum, and she is an early childhood educator as well, and a lot of her work is focused on nature-based play and outdoor learning, and so we discuss the ways ecological identity is taking shape or could take shape within Australian education systems. So Jan White, she is a professor of practice with the University of Wales, Trinity St David, and co-director of specialist training company Outdoors Thinking. Her work centres on provision for outdoor play for children in ECEC settings, with particular interests in play as self-directed learning, ecology as the study of relationships, landscape, embodiment, and the nurturing of ecological identity. During 40 years in educational practice, she has studied experience in the outdoors for children from birth to 12, collaborating with Siren Films to create the films Babies Outdoors, Toddlers Outdoors, and 2-Year-Olds Outdoors. And her award-winning books include Playing and Learning Outdoors, Outdoor Provision in the Early Years, and Every Child a Mover. Here are some parts of the interview that really stood out to me, and that relate to the topic of the show. So Jan says, pathways are one of the core things we need to meet our survival. That is, being able to travel and journey, something that children do a great deal of. Children move from one place to another to map a space out, and they come to know that space by moving. If you go through woodland, there is often one major, long, straight pathway, like a corridor, that offers a strong make-you-run shape, which children tend to do when they go down one. Then there are some smaller, less defined, wriggly pathways that have a lot more mystery to them. They offer intrigue and uncertainty, and they make you meander. Each type of path changes your way of being in the world, which is especially true for children. Tim Ingold says, wayfaring, I believe, is the most fundamental mode by which living beings, both human and non-human, inhabit the earth. I think those words wayfaring and inhabit are so important because our society pulls children away from building and maintaining relationships with the earth, and the task now is to help children actually inhabit the earth, and furthermore, to help adults regain that feeling of inhabiting the earth. When you walk along a path, even if it's a path that's already there, you're creating an experience with the path. There's an entanglement between you, the path, the world, the air you're breathing, and so forth. All of these components come together to co-create each moment. So when you're wayfaring, you're unconsciously creating a future together with the world. 100 years ago, or even when I was growing up, outdoor play was just what kids did. We stayed out until the streetlights came on and then had to go back inside for dinner. The British nursery school was actually built on the idea that children had to be outdoors for their health and well-being. Slowly, that understanding disappeared, and there are many factors as to why that is, but the most important part is that, simultaneously, within the education system, the understanding of the importance of the outdoors went away, along with the understanding of the need for play. Before that, we never had to analyse whether being outdoors was good for you, we just knew it, and we knew that that's where children ought to be. I think that if we can help children grow up differently, they can develop a different worldview and a different way of living in the world. For me, it boils down to how I feel myself in the world and how I know myself bodily in the world, and this affects the way I want to live. This is why my focus for some time has been on ecological identity, and within that, the pathway to that identification is playing with the world or knowing the world as a play partner. So what that means is, when children play with sticks or water or mud in the multitude of ways that they do, each of those represents the world responding to their drives. Children have psychological needs, like hiding or climbing, and the world has responded to that. For example, if there's a puddle, every child will jump into the puddle. It's almost as if the puddle is shouting at the child, "Jump in me." Or alternatively, the child jumps in the puddle and the puddle responds by splashing or squelching or whatever. Either way, there is this definite play partnership happening, which I think is a binding or bonding process that, over time, can become love. So if we can help children grow up and inhabit the world in a different way, then the way that they're driven to live will be different. You're less likely to harm and more likely wanting to care for something that you feel is your kin. It is possible for children to grow up like this. We see it in many Indigenous and other cultures. Another thing that I've been thinking about is the way that we use language in our Western existence. It's very noun-focused. Children live in the world of verbs. They live in the world of doing. We teach children nouns like nose, eyes, mouth, dog, cat, etc. But when we put a label on something to describe what it is, it generates a kind of separation between it and us. Instead, if I were to give a label that describes our interaction with it, then we get the intraction rather than the separation. When I'm with children, naming things doesn't matter so much. Instead, I like to focus on looking beyond the name. To do this, I have sometimes offered children the opportunity to choose the name themselves based on what they see and understand about something. Of course, sometimes labels are important in order to communicate with each other, but I feel that as soon as we say the name of something, we've categorized it and we've put it away and we've stopped looking and interacting. These Western human constructs of labeling really get in the way of seeing how things really are, and instead of a way of knowing, it becomes a set of knowledge. One of the things as well that I think the outdoors does very well compared to the indoors is it gives children a variety of surfaces to move along, whether it be by rolling, crawling, walking, or running. Indoors, there is one kind of floor. Even if it's wood or carpet or vinyl, there's very little variation, especially in how it responds to you moving things on it or moving upon it. It's a continuous and unchanging surface. In fact, children trip over indoors more than they do outdoors. This isn't evidenced by research, this is just my own observation, but they often trip over nothing when inside. There's a Danish landscape architect called Hal Nebelong who wrote about climbing frames being standardized in that every rung is the same distance and the same shape. She says, "When the distance between all the rungs in a climbing net or a ladder are exactly the same, the child has no need to concentrate on where he puts his feet." Standardization is dangerous because play becomes simplified and the child does not have to worry about his movements. Children move differently on irregular surfaces. For example, if a child is climbing or walking on a fallen down tree, there are all these lumpy, uneven, and knobbly bits of life that they get to know about and pay attention to because every step is different and every movement is different. Children need variety and difference for their development. The more the surfaces vary, the more you have to pay attention and the more your body has to think about how to respond. There are so many different types of surfaces in the outdoors and different variations within those surfaces. Like if it's raining, a surface might be slippery when it was grippy the day before. Walking on uneven surfaces means you have to have loose knees and a looser way of walking because you don't know what you're going to land on. And shoes have an impact on this as well. There's a book called Born to Run by Christopher McDougall, and there's a quote I like in it by Dr. Paul Brand that says, "A barefoot walker receives a continuous stream of information about the ground and about his own relationship to it, while a shod foot sleeps inside an unchanging environment. The foot is supposed to be splayed out, the toes are supposed to be able to grip and spread, and the arches are supposed to be able to take the pressure and push the foot forward. Shoes don't allow for this, and I think children should be allowed to walk barefoot a lot of the time so that they develop this spring in their step and stop the shock being referred up the legs, hips, and back. Feet are a great deal more robust than people think they are. However did we get by before shoes?" Children also don't want to wear shoes, and this makes me think that they might naturally know that shoes are not good for them. So those were some snippets from the interview I did with Jan. We're now going to hear a chat I had with my mum, who is an early childhood educator in Victoria, and she reflects on this concept and the practicalities of it in Australian education systems. tell me a little bit about your history as an early childhood educator in Australia and why or how ecological identity resonates with you.
Well, I have been teaching the early childhood field for over 40 years now, teaching and facilitating playgroups and supporting parents and children with disabilities in quite a range of different roles. And I guess I wasn't so focused on nature play, but I think, like Jan said in her interview, years and years ago, we didn't think about nature play or going outside with children. It was just something that we did all the time and never really thought about it. And then a few years ago, I started doing some relief teaching in a range of early childhood services, and I started to really notice, a decline in children wanting to be outside, which was quite unusual, and a decline in the educators supporting or understanding the benefit of being outside. And around about the same time, I heard Jan talk at a conference, and she started to talk about ecological identity, and it really made me think why this is becoming so important and how it's kind of disappearing. And I think she made a beautiful quote where she said, "Society pulls children away from building and maintaining relationships with the earth." And I think I've seen that in my own experience, not through studies or anything, though she can probably pull out some studies, but just from my observations, I could really see that we were preventing earth, the outside earth, the outside area became something to be feared and considered a bit dirty and considered a place where not great learning takes place. And I think that was a real shame. So now I feel really passionate that I need to encourage children and educators to be back out there in the nature places.
When did you sort of start noticing in Australia that shift with it being quite natural for children to play outdoors all the time and then it kind of transitioning into these like very sterile environments and safe environments to raise children? Have you noticed that happening in your career?
Probably over gradually, but maybe more so over the last 8 to 10 years. But I guess it was happening before that. I just wasn't so aware of it. There started to be this push in a lot of early childhood centres to have fake grass, very smooth, flat surfaces, not much to climb on, no more climbing trees. And we just became very risk averse, I think, probably because no one wanted to get sued. But thinking that we can still fill those gaps with other learning experiences, but I think we're beginning to realise now that that's not possible. And I think the first time a mum had said to me, I was working in a kindergarten and there were some logs that had been put as a border, and they were different, deliberately made different heights so that children could climb and balance, and they were rough, made out of like just natural stumps. And she asked if we could cut them all down to size and make them smooth so her child wouldn't hurt themselves. And that was probably the first time that I'd actually had someone say something. And it really hit home that this mum was frightened of what might happen in this natural space, and she wanted everything really perfect for her child. And then more recently, as I was visiting more services, I was noticing that children didn't necessarily want to go outside, which I thought was really strange because from my experience, children always wanted to be outside. And when they did get out there, they didn't really know what to do, probably because it wasn't as exciting, because there was a lot of fake grass, children weren't allowed to have bare feet, there were very strict rules about sand not being moved from the sandpit and mud puddles not being made. And I understand as an educator where that comes from, because it's a lot of extra work, but it was really depriving children of the opportunity to play with their imagination, to move things from one area to another, to roll down hills, to run really fast, to climb trees. That's pretty much not allowed just about anywhere in any educational service now. I shouldn't say anywhere, but in a lot, because of the risks associated with it. And I also saw, like, swings were taken out of a lot of early childhood services. And I mean, I'll talk later about how important that swinging, spinning and upside down play is for children's development. That was all taken away. So I guess risks, natural risks that children would normally take, were taken away. I saw some children climbing on a very low monkey bar, which is probably only a metre off the ground, with lots of tan bark and mats underneath. And the children weren't allowed to I was relieving there and I didn't realise that one child wanted to hang upside down and another child wanted to climb on top and sit on top. And I had supported them through this and talked them through it. And it took probably an hour for one of them to learn how to hang upside down with their legs over the bar and swing back and forth, and another one to work out how to climb up on this bar with me standing really close as another safety net. And then one of the other staff came over and said, they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to hang upside down. They're not allowed to climb on top. And when I asked why they just said it's not safe, you know, they'll fall and then a parent won't be happy. And there happened to be another educator next to me who was also relieving, who had worked mainly in schools, and she said, but if they're not taught or given the opportunity to learn this in a really safe environment, when they go to school, they're going to hurt themselves because they won't have those skills to do that, and they won't feel safe, and they'll avoid it. And that, you know, and that, so that's probably when it started hitting me that how it was changing. And then I had grandchildren a few years ago, and I started to watch them interact with the natural environment and thought, oh, this is so important. So important. And I didn't think about it with you and your sisters, I guess, because it was just a given that you would just play outside and interact, and I didn't really think about it so much. Yeah.
So then when did you notice, like, you mentioned how educators and parents were very aware of the safety risks of playing outside, and when did you sort of notice, like, because even you say when we were growing up, or probably when you were growing up, that wasn't much of a thing with parents. I mean, was there some sort of change, like, in policy or in, like, education centres to change this? Or
I think I read recently that this all started, I think, probably in America, when a child hurt themselves in a playground on a slide. They missed the rung and fell down and injured themselves quite badly, and so the parents sued the council. And I think that just started a wave of litigation. And that probably spread into the education system, and people were worried that if we don't make play really safe and clean, then people, we might be sued. And I guess it was all done with good intentions, but I don't think people really understood the negatives and the sort of unintended consequences of this.
And what are the long-term effects? I mean, you said children don't learn how to develop risk assessment.
I think that mainly and I take a lot of my information from a beautiful book called Balanced and Barefoot by Angela Hanscom, who is an occupational therapist who started the Timbernook schools, which are outdoor schools in America and pretty much all around the world now. But she talks a lot about sensory integration, which is combining all the sensory systems and having them work together to process the information that we receive from the sensory world. And if children don't have a sort of integrated, balanced sensory system, there'll be so many problems. I mean, I could list this, and which most educators and parents will say are around these days, you know, the poor balance, poor motor skills, poor attention, poor emotional control, more fidgeting, poor posture, more anxiety, decreased resilience. So many issues that are around that we see in children today that children are being diagnosed with. And there's a belief by a lot of people that if they just had more time in the outside, in the natural play spaces, some of these things wouldn't be occurring. And I mentioned the spinning, like, the five senses that we all know, that we all learn. There's another two, the vestibular sense, which is that comes from the inner ear, which is probably considered one of the most important, and that helps your balance and whether you're standing upright. And spinning and hanging upside down is just one of the best ways to develop this sense, and we've taken that away from children for safety reasons. And like rolling on the ground, how many kids used to roll down hills and get dizzy or spin themselves in chairs, and now we don't want them to do that because it's not very safe. A lot of children are allowed to spin on swings, which, you know, used to happen a lot. And the another sense, proprioception, which is the information you get from your muscles and joints and your bones and connective tissue about where your body in space and how much force you need to use. And if you never get to experience that, in our perfect worlds, think of your house and indoor classrooms and play centres. If It's very smooth floors, very little uneven ground. Children never have to learn to adjust and work out how much strength they need and how hard it to push their legs or how high they have to tiptoe to balance. And so we're taking that away from them, which means we're interrupting their sensory system, which if the sensory system isn't working really well at a young age, then it has all these implications for learning later on in school and just in life. So we are really taking that away from children. And I think when getting back to the ecological identity that Jan White talks about, she gives that beautiful example of children jumping in a child jumping in a puddle and how the puddle responds to them. So a child jumps, the puddle splashes, it makes a noise. And she calls it a play partnership.
Mm.
You don't get that off a plain wooden floor or beautiful, smooth, safe climbing frame, or because you don't get a reaction straight away, not as much. And if you get that beautiful partnership and reaction, you get love. And she says if you love something, then you're more likely to look after it. So if you can love the outside world and get a lot of enjoyment and pleasure from it and stimulation from it, because your body naturally seeks what it needs. So if you need movement, your body will seek movement. And if you can get that in the outside world, that is so much better because the movements will be bigger and grander and not forced to be small, I guess. So if you can create that love and relationship with the outside earth, maybe you're creating a love situation. And if you love something, then maybe you'll look after it more. Usually you would, I think.
Yeah, and Jan talks about that a lot. But what do you think in Australia, I mean, the limitations, because obviously you're so aware and other educators that you've worked with are very aware of like nature-based play and how important it is. But what are the limitations of kind of bringing that back into early childhood education in Australia and why it would be important to do that, especially given the kind of future of and the state of how climate change is impacting us now?
I guess it can be small or it can be big. In a big situation, there's a lot of programs now that do like beach kinder or bush kinder, and they're doing it in a big way, I guess. They're taking children out into these wild spaces, as wild as they can be, I guess, spaces where children can play with rocks and logs and actually play in a river or the beach. Obviously, there's safety guidelines around that, but those opportunities in those big spaces change all the time with the weather. And so children are learning to adapt and risk assess all the time. And so it's not the same environment. So they have to be very alert and they have to look at the changes. And just becoming aware of those changes helps them to understand the environment and then to love it for what it is and not to want to have that control over it, which I think that's the narrative that we're being told, that we have to have control or we're allowed to have control over the environment. We don't have to just live with it. But on a smaller scale, you can make the environments a little bit more natural, have some natural grasses, some more plants, some grass. And I know there's still a tendency to have fake grass because grass, when kids are on it, gets very muddy. But does that really matter? If I would say let the kids be in mud. Does that matter if parents... We have to convince the parents that it's okay to be messy and to come to kinder or early childhood centres in old clothes so that they can get messy. You can bring some nature things into the inside world, and that is a good start, but I guess it's still very controlled by the adult and controlled as to how much you can use it, and it still doesn't change with the seasons. And I think letting the children, you know, I have this conversation with a lot of educators about letting children be barefoot. You know, there's a lot of studies being done, and Angela Hanscom mentioned some in her book about how important it is for children to be outside in bare feet, because it not only helps the development of the foot, which in turn helps your posture and how you walk and how you hold your body, but it also provides a lot of sensory input into your feet, which helps your sensory integration. And I've heard people say, but it's not safe. I shared this story with you earlier, Shay, about one centre I went into, and they didn't want the children to be outside because there were some bees around. I didn't want them to be outside in bare feet. And that same day that they weren't allowed to take their shoes off, two children were stung by bees on their fingers, one because the child had picked a flower and one because they sat down and put their hand on the ground. And I thought that was just a perfect example of we're not protecting hands anywhere near as well as we're protecting feet. For some reason, but we are so precious about feet, but we let children play with scissors or use scissors, use sharp pencils, sharpeners, paper, where you can get a nasty paper cut. And we're not worried about that. We want children to experience all these sensory experiences with their hands because we know how important it is, but we're very precious about their feet. And I think, was it Jan? She quoted someone at Dr. Paul Brand that said, a barefoot walker receives a continuous stream of information about the ground and about their own relationship to it, while a shod foot sleeps inside an unchanging environment. And I think that kind of sums up the story of feet, but our bodies in general. If we're just inside or in a very manicured, perfect backyard or playground, our bodies are sleeping. They don't have to respond. They don't have to react. And that's not good for our minds or our bodies in any way, shape or form, really.
Yeah. Mm.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
I want to talk about a bit how, because it seems to kind of circle back to the nature-culture dualism a little bit, and how, you know, when we are very sheltered or asleep, like you said, we're sort of seeing ourselves in one way and then sort of viewing nature as out there, something far away, something to go outside and experience, but we don't see ourselves as like kind of inherently a part of it. And this is something that's very like central to Western culture, and obviously not every culture at all. But yeah, how do you think the best way, specifically like early childhood education in Australia, how we can go about practically really trying to build this ecological identity? Do you think it has to do with convincing parents that children are safe and there are a lot of benefits? Do you think it's sort of a policy thing? Do you think...
I think, look, Jan talks about we have to change the old narrative. We have to change what we've all been brought up to believe is that outdoors is kind of dangerous, that learning can't happen as well outdoors as sitting at a table indoors, that we as humans are exceptional and better, I guess, than everything else in the world, and therefore it's ours to control and manipulate and make it suit our lives. And so that's a big thing to change. And there's lots of policies and learning frameworks that really support our connection to a nature play now. So there are a lot of policies, and there's a lot of policies in place to support that. But they have to be weighed up against the risk and the encouraging, I guess, parents that it is okay and that the children are still safe. And as a parent, you know, safety, I guess, is priority for your own child. Like, so I guess it's just finding a balance. And for anyone who's a bit anxious about it, just do it in very small ways. You know, maybe just having a sandpit with water in it where children can wear bare feet. Keep it safe that way, and then gradually maybe move out into a bit more adventurous. When you see some of these programs that are really embracing nature play, you can tell that they've done all the risk assessments that are needed, and they adapt as they go, so that they don't just say, okay, children, just go and run and play and experience nature without any of the risk assessments being done. So people are really looking at that. And what is safe one day, say I know an educator takes the children to the Yarra River, and they play on the edge of it, and they throw rocks into it, and they build with washed up logs that have come up. And obviously on a really calm day when the river's low, the children can play differently to when there's been a storm and the river's very dirty and it's rushing really fast. So I guess it's kind of adapting as you go. Don't just say, this is what we're going to do. It adapts all the time because of the seasons and the weather conditions and the environment, and accepting that this changes all the time. And I guess understanding that all learning that happens inside can happen outside. Like, there's no benefit, more benefit to cutting a piece of paper than there is cutting some flowers or cutting grass. There's no benefit to writing with a pencil than there is drawing in the sand with a stick. You can thread bits of paper with, or, you know, thread like string with plastic beads, or you could thread daisy chains. I think just about anything you can do inside, I could find an activity that you could do that's outside is equivalent. The learning is very equivalent. And I think my experience mainly is with the very, you know, young preschool children. And most of those children need to use big physical movements to learn. It's not about the small movements. Children's development happens from the core in and then moves gradually out to the outer limbs. So they need big movements. If they can't get those big movements that their body naturally needs, that's when you see fidgeting, lack of concentration, inattentivity, you know, like that's when you see problems starting to arise. So we have to give those children those opportunities to move and have space to move. We don't need these perfect, manicured, beautiful aesthetic environments that don't provide any risks. And by risks, you know, age-appropriate risks. It doesn't have to be big, major risk, bungee jumping, just a risk for that child, for each child. And let each child sort of decide, have some say in what the risk is and how they evaluate the risk. And yeah.
And have you noticed sort of a difference? I know now you're doing some relief teaching in primary school. And have you sort of seen any differences with, or can you tell children that, it might not be obvious, but children that have kind of really grown up with a lot of outdoor spaces and have kind of prioritised outdoor learning, can you see the difference with kids like this and kids who have, you know, been inside a lot? And
I think I can see a difference, but I have not done research on it, so I wouldn't be able to say that it's just because of how they played outside. So I would never say that this is the whole cause. But we have to know that, like, children now are spending more time on screens. Parents are busier, so it's hard to take children to natural play spaces where there's lots of room to run and roll and climb, because most backyards aren't like that now. They're very quite small and quite manicured and very safe. And parents are often working, so it's hard to give them the time to take them to these places. Some of the early learning centres are very manicured, beautiful as well. To me, there has to be a correlation. And we're seeing such a rise in what schools would call difficult behaviour in terms of not being able to sit still, less resilient, more anxiety. You know, they often... people talk about children's eyesight getting worse. So there's a lot of research that says things are changing and not for the better. And it does correlate with children not being outside as much and having that freedom to be outside. Sometimes children are outside, but it's very scheduled and an adult is controlling the learning. They might go leave from school and go to footy training or soccer training, but that's very structured, very scheduled. That's not giving the children the opportunity to think for themselves. Or explore for themselves. So I personally think there is a difference, but like I said, I don't have the research to back that up. But
yeah. What do you think the potential is for actual climate change? What's the potential there to... Because, you know, what we're trying to do is raise activists, I guess, in a way.
Yeah,
you know?
And I think it goes back to that love. If you love the environment, the natural environment... which I think children will if they've got a relationship with it. Like what Jan talked about with the puddle. If you've got a relationship with the puddle, or she also talks about a meandering path going through a bush or somewhere. I don't think she calls it a bush because she's English, but in Australia we would call it through the bush. You have a relationship with it, and she compares that to walking on a wooden floor or a concrete path. You don't really have a relationship because you don't have to think about it. But if you're watching where you're going and avoiding puddles and going up hills, maybe on some unbalanced ground where you're wobbling or a log or something, you have a relationship with it. And you know that you can't control it, I guess, but you can care for it and you can look after it. And I think also not only, you know, the environment in relation to the plants and the trees and the earth, when you're out there playing and lifting up rocks and looking at trees and touching trees, you're noticing all the animals too. And you can start to really study them and observe them and notice their changes in everything over the seasons. And I think that observation at a really early age surely must help observational skills as you get older. And it's only those observational skills that will make you think, oh, something's changing in this world. Am I maybe responsible for some of that change? Or can, even if I'm not responsible, can I do something about it? But if you're oblivious to that change, and seasonal change, we don't really have to notice the seasons if we don't want to. We can stay inside with the heater or aircon on. We can get into the car with the heater or aircon on. We can go to the next building with the heater aircon on. We don't really have to be impacted by the environment if we don't want to be. So if children are out there in the environment and notice that, oh, one day there was water in the sandpit, now there's not. What's happened? Like, as oh, it's rained. Oh, and that's caused this is to be wet. It's just observational skills. And hopefully that is what will lead to activists, because they've observed something that's different. And if they observe it enough, they might notice that it's not, it's different, but not for the better, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's that attunement and awareness to what's going on around you, to your environment. Yeah, so thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to hear about all of the different ways ecological identity can be and is being kind of built in the context of education in Australia. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on 3CR 855 AM. Before the break, we heard from conversations I had with two early childhood educators. The first was Jan White, who is based in the UK, and the second was with my mum, Sue Wiedemann, who is based here in Victoria. We learnt from them about the importance of building and nurturing an ecological identity in children so that children can grow up to feel a part of the world and not separate from it, and therefore feel inspired to care for the environment and to become future climate activists. I just wanted to add that these conversations and this kind of theme is all coming from a very white Western perspective. Many Indigenous cultures around the world, and particularly in Australia, I don't think have the issue of needing to teach children to care for their environment and to regard the environment as kin rather than as a resource to use or something to control. You know, this is definitely a mindset that has come from the Western world and from capitalism. But unfortunately, the education systems that we have in Australia are colonial settler education systems, and that's why we need to be interrogating the way that they're run and why our Western culture needs a kind of shift and push towards nurturing children's ecological awareness. And I think we need more focus on and better support for outdoor play and nature-based learning in education centres so that children can grow up learning to inhabit the world differently and develop an early sense of care for their environment. As Jan said, if we can help children grow up and inhabit the world in a different way, then the way that they're driven to live will be different. You're less likely to harm and more likely wanting to care for something that you feel is your kin. I think this is really important to ensure the future of climate activism in a way, and to change our relationships too and our ecologies with the environment and with nature so that we and the next generation can start to build better worlds. Thanks so much for listening to the Climate Action Show. Today's episode was about building an ecological identity in children. We had the pleasure of hearing perspectives from Jan White and Sue Wiedemann, two early childhood educators. If you want to listen back, it will be up on the 3CR website. That's 3cr.org.au/climate-action.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.